Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford.
I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today listeners who are opera lovers are in for a treat because my guest is Gus Christie, who has the enviable, if tough, task of running Glyndebourne. In the beautiful heart of the Sussex countryside, Glyndebourne has become as well known over the years for its glamorous black tie picnics as for its world-class opera. For a family founded and run business, Glyndebourne has a mighty global reputation. Gus Christie, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you. Hello.
Now, before we get on to you and the significant improvements you've achieved since taking over your father's role as executive chairman in 2000, can you start by giving our listeners a brief history of Glyndebourne? Because it all began with a love story, didn't it?
That's right. Yes, it was my grandfather who was an opera lover, particularly Wagner's music, and he inherited the estate here at Glyndebourne in Sussex at an early age from his grandfather. In fact, he taught science at Eton. He was a captain in the First World War, and then was wounded, won a Victoria Cross, came back to England and invested in lots of local businesses, one of which was a building company. And then he built a very large music room to satisfy one of his passions, music, in which he would put on scenes from operas. He even partook occasionally in them himself, much to the delight of his domestic staff. He was at the time a 50-year-old bachelor. The organ room was built in 1920, and various professional singers would come down. He would invite them down, and there was a young soprano by the name of Audrey Mildmay from the Carl Rosa Travelling Opera Company, who was singing the role of Blonde in Mozart's Entführung. And he took a shine, took her up to his bedroom upstairs and said, this is where we're going to sleep when we get married.
This is meeting number one.
This is meeting number one, yes.
What was the age gap?
15 years.
Okay, so not too huge, but that's quite bold.
Very bold. He set about wooing her. I think he proposed three or four times. And the story goes, he took her to see Rosenkavalier at Covent Garden. And there's a point in the opera where Octavian presents Sophie with the rose. And at this moment, he produced a ring from his pocket and proposed to the unsuspecting Audrey. Well, maybe she was suspecting it by then. And I think on the third occasion, she relented, and they got married. And he didn't want her to go and sing around the world, so he built her a little opera house in his garden,
which is
300 seater, and it was like an old barn. It opened in 1934, and my grandmother sang the role of Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro, which was the first ever opera, she was pregnant at the time with my dad. So my dad was actually gracing the stage also at the opening night of the Glyndebourne Festival in 1934. But he set his sights very high, and his motto was not the best that we can do, but the best that can be done anywhere. And we still aspire to that today. I mean,
at what stage did your father take it over?
So my dad was very much groomed for the role. Uh-huh. He had an older sister. But he was groomed, and his dad being that much older, dad took over at the tender age of about 25, in the late 50s. And my grandfather died in 1962. His mum died, Audrey died in 1953 at a very young age.
Did she die? Because she was much younger.
It's a bit of a mystery. They were sent off to Canada in the Second World War, and my grandfather stayed back, and he shipped off Audrey and my dad and my aunt. and she got sick trying. He couldn't get money out to her, and she was basically having to sing for their supper out in Canada, and she never really recovered. David Hare wrote a play about the whole thing called The Moderate Soprano, so she died when Dad was not even 20. He was sort of 19. He got married to my mum in 1958, and he took over in the early in 1960, really. Mm-hmm. So he was pretty green. By then, it had grown to a theatre of about 850 seats. So the 50s was a good era. The 60s was difficult. I mean, they were living from hand to mouth from one year to the next, and it was the beginning of corporate sponsorship then, and it was all the cigarette companies who actually bailed him out. The reputation grew and grew, and Dad carried on. He made some canny decisions regarding sort of people running the ship, from the general directors to the music directors, and we had some wonderful... it was a wonderful place to grow up. My mum used to drag us backstage to go and wish all the singers good luck before the performances, and there were you know, various members of the company that would all come through the house, and I learned how to play tennis with Benjamin Luxon and various other singers, and snooker with members of the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and so it was sort of an extraordinary creative environment, really, to be brought up in.
Well, let's get on to you now, because you are not the first son, are you? And you were not necessarily groomed for this role, and in fact had a very thriving career as a wildlife documentary maker. Did you always want the role? Was it thrust upon you? What happened?
Well, I remember it well. When I was going for a walk up the downs with my dad, aged 19, and he casually mentioned that he thought I might be rather good at running Glyndebourne.
And you were studying zoology then, were you? Or about
I was. Yes. I was. I was studying zoology at London University. Mm. And I thought, oh, God, he's got me in his sights. it sort of daunted the hell out of me. But I remember it vividly, as does he. And I actually bought it up with him on his deathbed, and we both remembered the exact moment. So my dad knew exactly what he was doing, but he didn't force my arm. He just gently encouraged it. And my older brother went to live in North Devon and would not have been suitable for running Glyndebourne. And he readily admits that. And he just wasn't interested.
No,
he didn't want to do it, and my dad didn't want him to do it either. But I was very keen to sort of do my own thing. Mm. And my dad saw that, and so I read zoology at London University, and then was involved in the wildlife filming world for about 10 years. I did do a year, I think it was 1987, in the theatre. So I worked at the National Theatre backstage. I was part of the crew. Mm-hmm. I then worked at the Tricycle Theatre in
Kilburn.
And as a sort of production manager. And then I worked in Battignano. It was a festival in Italy where this man called Adam Pollock put on operas every year in the cloisters or in the orchard of this lovely old convent. And learnt a lot about how to put on an opera in that hot summer. And then I worked for Robert Fox on a couple of plays, one of which was Lettuce and Lovage with Dame Maggie Smith, which was a wonderful experience. But then the Call of the Wild took me back into, and I wanted to, I was very interested in film. And so I got a job as a runner for a company called Partridge Films, in also up in Kilburn, and spent 2 years in the cutting room, and then I was became a freelance cameraman. So I got my kit together and went to film otters on the Isle of Mull.
Oh, wonderful!
which was fantastic. And then I was very lucky to get offered a job in the Serengeti by Hugo van Loeck, whose first wife, Jane Goodall, has just
died. Yes.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Gosh. And I never met Jane, but Hugo was a great boss. So I learned a lot. I learned from him, and then became a freelance filmmaker and worked on a lion film out there. I filmed crocs hunting gazelles and honey badgers and golden jackals catching flamingos and the Ngorongoro crater and all sorts of things. And then my last film was a buffalo film for A Natural World for the BBC. But it was a wonderful experience. And I filmed in other places. I filmed tigers in India and red colobus monkeys in Zanzibar and elephant seals in California. So it was a wonderful thing to do for 10 years. And then I joined the board of Glyndebourne in 1989, I think. But I was very keen not to let the wildlife filming world know that I was even considering Glyndebourne, because had they got wind of that, I think they would have thought, oh, he's just biding time here. Mm. But I was quite, I hadn't really made up my mind.
So what was the moment when the baton actually exchanged hands properly?
Well, my dad turned 65 on the 31st of December 1999. We had a fantastic party on the stage. The new theatre was built in the early 90s. And so he handed it over in very good nick. Mm-hmm. And a brand new theatre with a reasonable kind of healthy financial setup. Anyway, we had this wonderful party on the stage, about 500 people, sit down dinner, and the whole backstage was opened up. We had a Cuban band, and there were speeches. There was this singer, Louise Winter, who popped out of this enormous cake that the prop department made, looking like Marilyn Monroe. and as I was sort of walking back at about 7 in the morning to the house over the hill where I was living, I was sort of thinking, my God, it was only in name only that the baton had been passed. So there then was a 2-year transition. So, and then we swapped houses in February 2002. So Mum and Dad went up to old house, a little farmhouse, just over the hill, out of sight at the Glyndebourne, where they spent the rest of their days. And we moved into Glyndebourne.
But you didn't give up filming altogether, did you?
We were the first opera house in this country to go into cinemas. So the Met were the kind of pioneers in America, but we were the first UK house to go in 2002, actually.
And then tell me about the education department, which is going to be 40 next year. Is that right?
That's right. It was started in the mid-80s by a wonderful lady called Katie Turl. And we have youth opera groups, so coming from the age of 8 to 18. And they come and work with vocal coaches and language coaches. And, I mean, we've had some great successes. They've actually come through and having been performed in children's choruses in the operas. Some of them have gone on to be in our chorus and go on to international careers. So it's a way in. We also have this academy called the Glyndebourne Academy, which is scouting the country for talent from sort of less privileged backgrounds. We had this Indian chap called Darwin Prakash who was plucked out of obscurity in India. I don't know how he came into our remit, but he did. And he's now singing a lead role in La Boheme this coming autumn.
Oh, now let's get on to that, because it's just, I'm talking to you at a very good moment, because it's starting in about 10 days, isn't it?
That's correct. Autumn festival. Yes. It's a very different feeling to the summer. And we want to basically sort of open the bonnet up and let people, and so we might leave the curtain down and so that the audience can see the scenes being changed. We want to kind of just show people what the sort of mechanics of the place. So we're bringing back two popular, very popular productions, La Bohème, which we did in the festival in 2022. It's set in Paris, and it's a great production. And then alongside that, we have Sir Peter Hall's iconic production of Benjamin Britten's The Midsummer Night's Dream, which was first done in 1981 here. And it's a Glyndebourne classic up there with the Cox, Hockney, Rake's Progress. So we're performing Bohème, Midsummer Night's Dream, and a world premiere of an opera called The Railway Children, which is based on Edith Nesbit's book. And it's nice to be doing something completely new.
How old will the singers, will you have any children in that?
No, I mean, they're quite young. They're young, very young singers. Mm-hmm. It's part of the whole point of our autumn season is to bring on the up and coming talent, both on stage and in the pit. And we have young conductors who go on to amazing things. It's a great springboard for future talent. And we also have another scheme within the actual orchestra pit. It's called Pit Perfect, and we have about 10 young musicians, and some of them go on to become members of the orchestra of what's called the Glyndebourne Symphonia, who play for our autumn season.
And what are you doing about your own legacy? Because you have 5 sons and a daughter, don't you?
I do, yes. I've got 4 older boys from my first marriage and a 10-year-old son, Bacchus, and a 4-year-old daughter, Scheherazade. So I've got a few to choose from.
Yes. Any obvious contenders?
We haven't chosen one yet, but I think it'll all get revealed a bit more in the next few years. All the older boys are making their own way and doing their own thing, which is absolutely right. And it is a national institution. Once you commit to it, it is a lifelong commitment. That's the thing. Mm.
So what will you do if none of them want to take it on? Listeners, you missed a very good large shrug.
What can you do? I mean, you can't force it on anyone, can you?
No.
So I mean, there's nothing worse than having some inheritance that you don't want thrust on you. As my dad did, I think I'm trying to sort of make it better than when I took it on. So we're investing a lot in the physical site. We have a lot of plans to sort of, we're heading to our centenary in 2034.
Good Lord, gosh.
So, by which time I'll be 70 and probably still here, I hope. But we're looking, we're in a position of strength at the moment. We've come out of the pandemic in a very good financial position, and we didn't close down during the pandemic. We carried on, actually. We performed in the grounds, in the gardens. We built 2 stages, and people were so unbelievably grateful that we were putting anything on. And we kept, we didn't make anyone redundant, made a lot of friends, I think. The theatre's 30 years old. We've just spent £7 million on a backstage automation project. We've just replaced the stage floor. We've just refurbished the orchestra pit. A massive new production hub facility backstage where the costumes are made. And so we're now looking at just the whole site and what we can do to actually enhance the customer experience, enhance our artistic potential, and future-proof ourselves as much as we can.
Can I ask us a somewhat personal and naive question? Does it help being, I mean, you very famously have had this huge love affair with Danielle, which has been very public and very romantic. Does it help being married to someone who shares your love? Yes.
Of course.
I mean,
she's also, I mean, it gives me a great insight into what it's the life of an opera singer as well, which is not an easy existence. And they are, most of them are sort of singing around the world and away from home. And they get the plaudits on the stage and then they go back to their lonely apartments, wherever they're staying. She's a fantastic singer, a fantastic artist, and she treats us in the same way that she treated us before we got married, which is a sort of very professional, and she won't take on a role unless she really wants to do it, et cetera, et cetera. And we're lucky to have her, really. I mean, you know, she helps to sell tickets, and she is a consummate sort of professional and does and puts her heart and soul into anything that she takes on. She sang last in The Merry Widow last year, and she's going to be singing Carmen for us in 2 years' time. She's a huge help to me, and it's you know, you can't do something like this on your own. I mean, my dad ran it for 40 years.
Yeah.
And he very much turned Glyndebourne from a sort of homespun opera house into the international festival that it is now.
With a global reputation.
He said to me, I mean, it's sort of, you've got to have an eye on the future and kind of, you've got to remain relevant in what we do on stage and who we hire, the creative teams we hire. But it's quite good to have an eye on the past as well and to kind of maintain tradition.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why we ask people to dress up to come here. You don't have to wear a black tie, but we say it's customary. And we're now fighting that a bit. There's a lot of people who are coming in any old thing.
Do you ban anything like trainers or jeans?
We don't, but they stand out like kind of stand out a lot, and it's. But I think it puts you in a different mindset if the audience make an effort to wear nice things. Or I mean, we don't care. You can wear whatever you like, but dress up, make an effort. Is because we're making an effort, so it's out of respect to the artist that you're seeing. And I think it makes the whole experience more special the people watching is part of the whole event. And I think it's why we're doing it so well, I think, is because Glyndebourne is an event, it's an experience, and it's not just going to your local theatre.
Well, I think that is utter music as well as the opera itself to every oldie listener out there. What a lovely, lovely place to end on. Gus Christie, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Gus Christie. If you've enjoyed this and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to our magazine. In the meantime, thank you so much again, Gus. My very warm thanks to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us and to you for listening. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.